yeah. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. The great Coco Taylor, Voodoo Woman. And that you can hear on Alligator Records. And my guest is Bruce Aglauer, who is the founder of Alligator Records, which is the world's foremost blues and roots rock label. They're currently celebrating its 45th anniversary, and there's a bunch of special tributes planning that are planned, and we'll get to all of those. And here to talk about this incredible label and the artists on the label and how the label started and all that great stuff is Bruce Aglauer. And we welcome Bruce. Bruce, how are you?
Great, thanks. Glad to be on the show. I've listened to you many times.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you, man. Let's talk about how it all started. It goes back to 1971, and you were working as a shipping clerk at Delmark Records, correct?
Right. I moved here at the beginning of 1970 because I had fallen in love with the blues, and of course, Chicago is the world capital of the blues. And I went to work for Delmark Records for a magnificent $30 a week, packing boxes and unloading trucks and whatever needed to be done. Definitely not the important executive job in any way, shape, or form. One of the things I was lucky to have happen, though, is when the boss, Bob Kester, had a recording session, he brought me along as the gopher, you know, the guy who goes for sandwiches or goes for a drink for one of the guys in the band or yeah. Whatever errands need to be done.
Yeah. And so that's how it started, yeah?
Yeah, within a week after I moved to Chicago, I was in a recording studio with Junior Wells, Buddy Guy, Otis Spann, Fred Bielo, and Ernest Johnson. And I thought I had moved from Wisconsin to heaven.
Now, before we get into what happened after that and how it got going, what was your first exposure to the blues, Bruce?
Well, I was part of the folk music boom of the 1960s. I had my acoustic guitar and my harmonica in a rack, and I was an actively bad musician. But my sister, who was the brains of the family, went to school at University of Chicago, and I was up in Wisconsin going to college. And the University of Chicago every year has a folk festival, usually end of January or early February. And in 1966, at the end of January, I came down to the University of Chicago Folk Festival, and I heard a guy named Mississippi Fred McDowell. A solo blues artist, played with a slide on his little finger, played what's called Mississippi Hill Country Blues. And I was probably in the 20th row, and it was just like he was singing directly to me. And he was shaking me and saying, "Wake up, wake up, this is for you, wake up." And that's when I fell in love with the blues. Went back to my little college in Wisconsin. I bought every blues record I could get my hands on. I did the blues show on the college radio station. And then starting in 68, I began coming back to Chicago because I had heard about this guy, Bob Kester, and his store, the Jazz Record Mart, which has been in the news a lot recently.
Yeah.
And his label, Delmark Records. And at that time, all of the blues in Chicago was on the south side and the west side in the black neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
There was no north side blues scene at all. And it was mostly little neighborhood clubs, no signs, no advertising. But Bob knew where these places were, and he was my guide. And I began going out to the blues clubs, coming down on the weekends. And then I talked him into giving me a job and moved here. And I was spending every night of the week in a blues club somewhere on the south side or west side. So it was a wonderful time, and I was just so excited, but I never was thinking about having my own label. I was enjoying working for him.
Yeah. Now tell me about some of the artists that really made an impression on you. I mean, you obviously, if you were in a blues club every night in this city, you had to see some amazing performers.
I did. I could see Howlin' Wolf two or three nights a week. I saw Muddy a few times, not in concerts, but in neighborhood clubs, Muddy Waters. I was able to see Freddie King, the great guitar player from the West Side, Jimmy Dawkins, Kerry Bell, a wonderful harmonica player, Junior Wells, who I mentioned, down at Teresa's Lounge, and Buddy Guy, often at Pepper's Lounge on 43rd Street, and bands like the Aces, who were a crack studio band, and lots of unknown people who were just wonderful. And shortly after I moved to Chicago, I was down at Teresa's Lounge, and I ran into a guy named Hound Dog Taylor. Big, tall, lanky guy, real skinny, with a high-pitched laugh and kind of a lot of nervous energy. And he told me that I knew he was a musician. He told me he had a gig on Sunday afternoons at a club called Florence's Lounge at 54th Place in Shields, which is just west of the expressway, just off of 55th Street, of course. And I thought, well, Sunday afternoon, nobody else is playing. I'll go down there. And I wasn't really expecting much.
Yeah.
But I thought it might be an interesting scene. And I walked in, and I heard music that was so happy, so joyful, so energetic that I just was sucked right in. Hound Dog was a slide player, just like Fred McDowell, the guy who had sold me on the blues. It was a three-piece band, two electric guitars and a drum set, no bass player, raw, distorted, nasty, incredibly rhythmic music. I can't dance, and I could dance to that band. And they just made you grin. You know, people think the blues is sad music. This was the happiest music I had ever heard. So I went back to my boss, and I said, you've got to record these guys. You've got to record these guys. And he had seen Hound Dog sitting in at jam sessions. And sitting in, Hound Dog Taylor was a disaster. Nobody could follow him. The songs fell apart. Mm. And, you know, he was a very kind of a comical guy, told jokes a lot and laughed at his own jokes. And so Bob, my boss, Bob, didn't take him very seriously. So when I couldn't convince my boss to record my favorite band, I started a record label to record my favorite band. And 45 years later, I'm still recording my favorite band.
It's amazing. That really is amazing. Tell me about the first record and how it was recorded. It was recorded just live in studio, right?
Right. I couldn't afford to do, you know, 4-track or 8-track or 16-track recording. I brought the band in, same band I heard at Florence's Lounge, set them up with their same raggedy amplifiers and kind of cheap drum kit, just like they were in the club. I didn't even use headphones. I used speakers pointing back at them so they could hear the vocals. And so there was a lot of bleed. You know, there was no, it was not a pristine recording in any way. And I knew this band so well that I worked with the engineer, and we mixed the record as it was being recorded.
Wow.
There was no going back. Whatever it sounded like going to tape, that was the way it was going to sound forever. And we recorded, we spent about 8 hours in the studio, actually, literally 45 years ago this month, and June, one session in May, one session in June. Mm-hmm. And we recorded multiple takes on 25 of the songs that they were doing in their regular show. And then I just went through and picked the best performances for the first record.
And how much did the record cost to make?
The studio bill, including the mastering, which is where they cut the big master disc, because this was the LP days, you know,
yeah.
no CDs, and yeah. Actually before cassettes, my entire bill was $900.
Oh, man.
And then I gave the band some money, too, which turned out to be just the beginning of some amazingly large royalties that they earned over a number of years.
Mm.
But I gave Hound Dog $480. I gave the other two guys in the band $240, and they were really happy.
That's amazing. And you pressed 1,000 copies of the record.
It was all I could afford to press.
Yeah.
And I put them in the back of my car, and I started driving. And first I visited some radio stations in Chicago, and Delmark Records, my boss's company distributor in Chicago, was a really good one. So I talked him into taking my one record, and then I drove to Detroit, visited three radio stations, and this was the days of, you know, freeform progressive rock,
yeah.
FM radio,
yeah.
When rock and roll first got on the FM band, and all the DJs could program their own shows. There were no playlists, and the music directors were basically just another DJ. So all of these DJs I would meet as I came, stayed at the stations. I would often stay at a station for 24 hours and meet each DJ as he or she came on the shift.
Okay.
And hand them a personal copy of the record and say, hey, I'm from Chicago, and I'm a blues fan, and I recorded my favorite band, and here's the record. Would you play it, huh? and they were all pretty open to playing it. So within a day, I was getting airplay, and then I went to a distributor, and said, "Hey, I've got three stations in your marketplace playing this record. Will you distribute it?" And usually they said yes, and I would take 100 copies out of my car, leave them with the distributor, and then drive to the next city.
Wow.
So I went to Detroit and Cleveland and Buffalo and Hartford and Boston and New York and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., distributing records out of the back of my car.
Wow. All right, listen, Bruce, hang on, okay?
Sure.
We got to take a break, but, man, this is an incredible story. Celebrating the 45th anniversary of the great Alligator Records, there's a lot of stuff in store, and we've got much more to talk about with the founder of Alligator Records, and we'll do that right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. There's a better home waiting in the sky. Yes. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6. My guest is Bruce Iglauer, who is the founder of Alligator Records. It's the world's foremost blues and rock and roots rock label. And they're celebrating 45 years, if you can believe it. You can check out alligator.com for more information. That was Mavis Staples, by the way, one of the label mates. And we're talking about the 45th anniversary and how it all started. Bruce, welcome back to the show, sir.
Thanks, Nick.
You must be very excited about the entire day dedicated to Alligator Records at the Blues Festival this year.
Well, I'm very honored that they have given us a day. We're going to have some bands on the smaller stages, and then on the big band shell stage, we have Shamika Copeland with a wonderful singer named Curtis Salgado from Portland, mm-hmm. Oregon, who will be guesting with Shamika. We have Little Ed and the Blues Imperials, Chicago's own, with Chicago's own Corky Siegel sitting in on harmonica.
Wow.
And to open the show, we've got Tommy Castro, a terrific musician from the Bay Area, and Chicago's own Toronto Cannon will be sitting in. So that's going to be the festival headline show on Friday, June 10th, which is also the day that we're releasing this two-CD set, the Alligator Records 45th Anniversary Collection.
And now, how did you decide what was going to go on this two-disc anniversary CD?
Oh, it's very tough. You know, my records are like kids to me. They're like my children. And I don't release a record unless I really believe in it and care about the musician and love the music personally. So it was a matter of what I could fit on. There were some hidden gems, like a track from 1978 by Jimmy Johnson, a terrific Chicago guitar player and singer, and a track by A.C. Reed, a wonderful saxophone player, and Bonnie Raitt sits in on that one. Then, of course, I had to include Hound Dog Taylor, our first artist, and Coco Taylor, the queen of the blues, who was with us for 35 years.
Yeah.
And whom I managed personally and also traveled around the world with, often as her tour manager. And Sun Seals, who was the third artist who recorded for the label and did 9 albums for us. Albert Collins, the great Texas guitar player. Mm-hmm. And those people were essential. Mavis Staples, whom you mentioned. We only have one record by Mavis. It came to us as a finished record, produced by a local producer named Jim Tullio, and it was the beginning of Mavis's career as a solo artist. I'm very proud of the record.
Yeah.
Then I wanted to feature some of the artists who have come to us more recently because we're nurturing a bunch of visionary young blues and roots rock artists who I think will be bringing this music into the rest of the century and beyond. Artists like Selwyn Birchwood from Florida, Jerika Singleton from Mississippi, Toronto Cannon, who I mentioned from right here in Chicago, Shamika Copeland, I also mentioned, who comes from New York but actually lives in Chicago now and is married to Buddy Guy's bass player, J.J. Gray and Mofro from Florida, and Anders Osborne from New Orleans. And all these are very visionary artists who are reinventing the blues tradition and keeping it contemporary.
Now let's talk about the place itself. It started in your apartment in Edgewater, correct?
Actually, in Uptown.
In Uptown, okay.
Right. I was very close to the Sheridan L station right by that big screening curve, metal on metal curve, and about every 10 minutes, my apartment would be filled with the sound of steel on steel 24 hours a day. It was a lot of adapting after moving from northern Wisconsin.
I bet. You know, it's funny, Bruce. I grew up right next to the Addison Brown Line station. It was right it was right out my bedroom window. But at least that was a stop. You know, like they had to stop. You're right there. They're flying by.
Oh, yeah. And it was disconcerting for quite a while. And the neighborhood itself was pretty rough at that time. It's actually the very north edge of Wrigleyville, just south of Irving Park. And at that time, there was a lot of drug dealing going on, and I would often hear gunshots at night. It's much nicer now.
Yes.
Then after 5 years, I rented a house in Edgewater. And I ran my business, I have to say, since I can't get busted now, illegally out of my house for 10 years.
Wow.
Starting as I was the label, I was the only employee, and I was warehousing in the basement and using a spare bedroom for my office. By the time I left 10 years later, I had 7 employees coming to my house every day. I had a copier in the dining room. The kitchen had 7,000 cassettes in it.
Oh, my God.
It was insane. and I finally couldn't handle it anymore in the house. And so I bought a building in Edgewater about 5 blocks from where I live. I'm still living in the house that I bought in 1975.
That's incredible. Is it a regular house now? Are all the business stuff in the building 5 blocks away?
I still maintain an office in my house because I kind of never stop working.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise,
it's like a real house, yes.
Oh, you know, I can't believe I didn't ask this yet. What's the origin of the name of the label, Alligator? Why is it called Alligator? Because this is a great story.
Oh, well, Alligator was my nickname. When I started the label, I had a girlfriend. I had a few girlfriends, but I had a girlfriend in particular who called me Little Alligator because I have a habit of listening to music and playing drum parts by clicking my teeth together. And it's not something I do consciously, but she thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And it reminded her of an alligator, you know, chomping its jaws down. So she began calling me Alligator. When I started the label, you know, I've got this crazy last name, Iglauer. Nobody knows how to pronounce it or how to spell it. And I thought, I don't want to be spelling my name all my life. Alligator, you know, it starts with a vowel, it ends with an R, it's got a G and an L in it. It's a lot like my last name. Alligators are from the South. The blues started in the South. You know, everybody knows the word alligator. It's got an image. And plus, alligators are tough and mean and vicious. And I thought, boy, when I'm trying to collect money from those distributors, I want them to think I'm dangerous. And if they knew me, they'd know I wasn't dangerous at all. So I liked the name, and it evoked an image. A wonderful designer, a Chicago designer named Michael Trossman, designed my logo as a favor to me, just because he liked the idea of the label, and he was a Hound Dog Taylor fan. And we kind of modeled it a little bit on the crocodile from Walt Disney's Peter Pan. So it's a very happy-looking alligator with a big stomach.
Right. That's a great story. Okay, so how many employees are now working at Alligator 45 years later?
Well, besides myself, 15 others.
Mm-hmm.
We do almost everything in-house except have a recording studio. I go out of town or out of the office to do my recording, but we have our own publicists, our own radio promotion people, our own graphic designer, international and national sales managers, a new media person who deals a lot with social media, financial people, and then we run a mail order business as well. So it's very busy at all times.
I bet. And now
my employees are incredible, and many of them have been with me over 20 years and some over 30 years.
Wow. Now let me ask you this. How have you and Alligator Records, because, well, you are Alligator Records, but how have you dealt with the way technology has changed the business and how the business has changed? I mean, 45 years is a long time to be recording music, and so much has changed in that 45 years. What were the pros, what were the cons, and how did Alligator and yourself deal with these changes?
Well, I've never been resistant to technology, and I never wanted to get stuck in a place where I was just bemoaning the fact that it wasn't like it used to be in the good old days. So we started with LPs. Fairly quickly after that, we released a few 45s. We actually put out some 8-tracks for your older listeners who remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Then our whole catalog was available also on cassette starting in the early 80s. And very early after CDs came along, we committed to putting out our blues artists on CD, and we became the first blues label to have an extensive CD catalog. And it helped us a lot to get into different stores at different markets. We began selling on the internet in 1994.
Wow.
We put up our website in 1994 and began selling at that time. As soon as the download services like iTunes and Amazon's download service came along, we began doing business with them and making our music available as downloads because that's what the public wanted. And now, of course, streaming on demand with services like Apple Music and Spotify are becoming the dominant way that people are accessing music, and we're dealing with all of them as well. It means we have to learn new ways of marketing and new economic models all the time, and we're waiting for the next technology, and we'll adapt to that as well.
Yeah. And now, are some of the people that you brought in you said a lot of people have worked for you for a very, very long time. Had you had to bring in new people who are better at this technology or more experienced, younger people?
Well, trust me when I tell you that I am not very good at this technology.
Okay.
I know how to make a really good blues record, but as far as, all the subtleties of the digital world, I'm not so great at those. I have a terrific employee named Josh Lindner, who is, even though he's not a kid, has kept up with all of these technological changes and is constantly telling me about new ways we can get our music to the public's ears. And also, I do call on some of my younger employees, but even my younger employees are pretty grown up now.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, listen, we have to take a break, Bruce. When we come back, we'll talk more. I want to hear some stories, some of your favorite stories about recording and dealing with some of the artists and stuff like that. And we'll also tell you about some more of the celebrating that's going to be happening for the 45th anniversary. And so, Bruce Iglauer, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. Bruce is with us. He is the founder of Alligator Records, celebrating its 45th anniversary. So many great things are happening, including an entire day dedicated to Alligator Records at the Chicago Blues Festival, the release of a 2-disc anniversary CD, and the reissue of a DVD called Pride and Joy, the story of Alligator Records. And again, we are giving copies of that away Friday morning when Jeff Tuckman is here. All right. Stick around. We'll take a quick break and talk more with Bruce right after this on 720 WGN. Yeah. All right. Welcome back to the show. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trip Tower. That is the great Delbert McClinton, who, of course, is a longtime friend of Stephen Johnny's, who used to do this shift, and that was Giving It Up For Your Love, Delbert McClinton, and part of the Alligator Records label. And that's what we're talking about with the founder of Alligator Records, Bruce Iglauer. Bruce, can you believe it's been 45 years?
It seems like about 5 years.
Yeah.
I've been doing this almost every day. You know, my wife laughs about this. Even on our one-day honeymoon, I had to take a 2-hour break because Coco Taylor, whom we managed and was my dear friend, was cutting a national commercial for Alka-Seltzer, and she wanted me in the studio because she was working with a producer she wasn't used to. So in the middle of my one-day honeymoon, I spent 2 hours in a recording studio helping my artist take a commercial.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
And my wife is pretty amazing to put up with me.
I bet. So let me ask you about this DVD, Pride and Joy, the story of Alligator Records. It's going to be reissued as part of the 45th anniversary celebration. And Jeff Tuckman is coming in on Friday morning, and we're going to give a few copies away. Tell us about Pride and Joy, the story of Alligator Records.
Well, Pride and Joy is actually, you said it's a reissue. It was actually made about 24 years ago. On our 20th anniversary, actually technically on our 21st anniversary, we did an Alligator 20th anniversary tour. And that put together Coco Taylor, the Queen of the Blues, Lonnie Brooks, a great West Side Chicago blues man, Elvin Bishop, who had been part of the legendary Paul Butterfield band and kind of combined blues and Southern rock. A band I love, Little Ed and the Blues Imperials from right here in Chicago, and Katie Webster, a terrific Louisiana piano player and singer. And I put everybody on a bus, 21 people, and we went from city to city putting on concerts. A filmmaker who had done a number of music documentaries named Bob Muggy heard about this. I was in touch with him, and he decided that he had to make a film around this tour. So he got together a crew and raised some money and shot a show in Philadelphia at the Chestnut Cabaret with all of these artists. So there's a lot of live music on this video. That's the best part. Then there also is quite an in-depth interview with me at that time, and also a tour of our offices, some footage of the artist speaking. So there's a lot of insight into the label, but the live music part is just very entertaining.
That's great. Pride and Joy, the story of Alligator Records, is being reissued as part of the 45th anniversary of Alligator Records. Bruce, do any, all these years you've been doing this and the way that it's been done, you're so hands-on, you work every day, every hour. What are a couple of stories that stand out, a couple of artists and stories that you really, really jump out at you?
Well, one of the most exciting records I made was the debut record by Chicago's own Little Ed and the Blues Imperials. The reason it was so exciting and surprising was I wasn't intending to make a record with them. Mm. I was doing an anthology to introduce 10 of the better young and new unseen bands in Chicago in the mid-1980s. We called it the New Blue Bloods. And I was asking each band to record a couple of songs, and then I'd choose which one I wanted to put on the record. 10 bands, 10 songs. The third band I brought into the studio was Little Ed and the Blues Imperials. So after they had done their two songs, I had 3 hours of studio time left. So I said, hey, guys, you want to record a few more? And Ed, seeing myself and my wife and a couple of my employees and the engineer on the other side of the glass, where the engineer sits,
yeah,
began putting on a show for us. So the band was playing live. He would sing a verse and then run out, maybe fall on his knees and lie on his back and play a slide guitar solo and then jump up and run back to the microphone or walk on his toes because he had an audience. And in the course of that 3 hours, we recorded 30 songs.
Wow.
10 songs in, I had so fallen in love with this band that I came out and I said, guys, something magic is happening here tonight, and I want to capture it, and I want to sign you to the label. I don't want to sit here and negotiate a deal right now. I want to keep this thing going. And now, here we are 32 years later, and Little Ed is still with the label. His brother, the bass player, is still in the band, along with two other guys who have been in the band a mere 27 years each. And we're in the process of rehearsing for a brand new album right now. We'll be in the studio next week.
And they are performing at the Blues Festival.
Right. They will be performing at the Petrillo Band Shell on Friday, June 10th.
Right.
With a special guest appearance by Corky Siegel on harmonica. And this is still a very rough and ready band. They are not slick. They don't try to be slick. It's as raw as blues should be.
Yeah.
And it's just full of energy. And if this band can't make you grin, then you're dead.
Oh. All right. When you can see that as part of the 45th anniversary celebration, the Chicago Blues Festival, that'll be on June 10th in Grant Park. The two-disc anniversary CD will be coming out, and the reissue of the DVD of Pride and Joy, the story of the Alligator Records DVD, that's also coming out, and we'll be giving that away on Friday morning when Jeff Tuckman is here. Before we let you go, and Bruce, I could talk to you all night, but before we let you go, we've been losing a lot of incredible musicians lately, and one of whom we lost last week was Lonnie Mack. And is there anything that you can say about Lonnie?
Well, I had the real pleasure of recording three albums with Lonnie Mack in the 1980s. Lonnie comes from my hometown of Cincinnati. He was a fabulous guitar player and a tremendously soulful singer who combined country music and blues and R&B and rock all into one natural synthesis. He was famous as a guitar player, but he was equally good as a singer. I did the first album with him in the same year, 1984, and his protege and biggest fan, Stevie Ray Vaughan, produced the record. The very first 45 Stevie ever bought was Wham! By Lonnie Mack.
Right.
And Stevie produced the record and played on the record, and it was a revival of Lonnie Mack's career. He gave us some thrilling shows. We did a live album with him in 1989 called, he had Gibson Flying V guitar,
right,
for your listeners who know what that is,
right,
number seven, the seventh one made.
Mm-hmm.
And we did an album called Attack of the Killer V. He also mounted one of those tremolo bars on it,
right?
A Bigsby tremolo bar. And after he made the single Wham!, those bars became known universally as Whammy bars,
named
after the song.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's such a great story, Bruce. Congratulations on 45 years, man. And thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you.
I'm now planning the next 45 years.
Awesome. That's great.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, take care. Bruce Iglauer, and the founder of Alligator Records. We got to take a quick break here on 720 WGN.